Hello everyone, welcome to this week's edition of the Spanish Shorter Podcast with me, Phil Kitramelides, and Sid Lowe. It's a big one, this podcast, usually is, after El Clásico. We had the first Clásico of the season, which saw Real Madrid beat Barcelona by 2-1 at the Camp Nou. But it's a funny one, Sid, because the Clásico, probably shouldn't be saying this, or maybe we should, maybe it's a great advert for the division. Clásico might have been the worst game of the weekend.
Yeah. I think I should probably point out at this stage that the two games that I had to cover were the two worst games of the weekend by some way, because I did this and Cadiz against Alaves for the radio on Saturday.
Yes.
I mean, the game of the year, the Clásico, wasn't even the game of the weekend. It wasn't even the game of the day. As you say, it was definitely the worst game of the day, because Sunday had some real belters, didn't it? And then you know, the Clásico kind of wasn't.
This is what happened on match day 10. On Friday night, Osasuna could have gone top of the table, albeit temporarily, had they beaten Granada. They were on track to do so, but they conceded a ridiculous 90th minute equaliser, Angel Montoro scoring from way, way out. Osasuna goalkeeper Sergio Herrera going walkabout. It really is a quite ridiculous goal. Anyway, it finished Osasuna 1, Granada 1. Then on Saturday, we had Valencia scoring twice in injury time in the 93rd and 98th minutes to salvage a 2-2 draw at home to Mallorca. Then there was that far from magnificent game between Cadiz and Alaves. Alaves getting their first away win of the season, winning by 2-0. Elche against Espanyol was an absolute belter. It finished 2-2. Espanyol seeing Raúl de Tomás score once again. And then Athletic Club got a big win at home to Villarreal, beating them by 2-1. Sunday saw the craziest game of the season so far, the highest scoring game in La Liga for well over 2 years. Sevilla 5, Levante 3, but this game could easily have ended 11-6. It was that crazy. Then we had the Clásico. Real Madrid beating Barcelona 2-1 at the Camp Nou, a fourth consecutive Clásico win for Real Madrid. That hasn't happened since the mid-1960s. Betis beat Rayo Vallecano by 3-2. Rayo had pulled it back to 2-2, but then Betis got a penalty and duly dispatched it. And then another big game of the weekend, Atletico Madrid, the champions, against leaders at Real Sociedad. La Real raced into a 2-0 lead before Atleti pulled it back. 2 from Luis Suarez, making it 2-2, although the point keeps Real Sociedad a point clear at the top of the La Liga table. We're recording on Monday night, just an hour or so before Sydney has to pop out and watch Getafe against Celta, Sid. That is real dedication to your art, but it's what we've come to expect from you.
I mean, as we've just mentioned, the two...
I mean, I use the word art in the loosest possible
yes,
sense.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The two perhaps less good games of the weekend were the two that I had to cover. I really hope this isn't going to be a magnificent hat-trick in an otherwise belting weekend.
Guys, if you're listening, I've got a suggestion. Why don't you come and join us over at patreon.com/TSFP. It costs €4.25 a month. This week, we'll have a Q&A pod answering your questions, a bonus pod looking at La Liga's midweek match day 11. We'll have another episode of TSFP Presents discussing another iconic, messy moment. And you get producer Al's paper reviews and access to the TSFP Discord, which is a brilliant community of like-minded individuals, all for about €1 a week. It's pretty good value. So if you like Spanish football, you might want to consider joining us. All right, the talking points of the weekend. We said it wasn't the best game, but we have to start with the Clásico, the most high-profile fixture, I was going to say, in the world. I've spent the last 24 hours receiving constant non-stop tweets from people saying it's not the biggest game in the world, that's Man United, Liverpool. Blah, blah, blah.
It is the biggest game in the world.
Well,
I'm
tell
sorry,
us why it's the
I'm
biggest
sorry,
game
it is. It is. By the way, I assume they must have, and forgive me for my ignorance of cricket, I assume they must have played each other this weekend, because I got loads of tweets telling me that the biggest game in the world is actually India against Pakistan.
India against Pakistan, yeah, I got
which I have seen. The World Cup that was in England, in what year would it be? Oof. 98, okay. 99, something like that.
Veering dangerously off tangent.
Yeah, well, that's anyway, and it was a lot of fun, but I don't know if it was as big as a Clásico. Anyway, why is the Clásico the biggest in the world? Because it is a club.
You wrote a book about it.
Yes, obviously, it's a club game with almost an international feel to it. They are I think financially, until the last year, I think the two biggest clubs in the world economically, they are the clubs with the most Ballon d'Or winners. In fact, they've basically had all of the Ballon d'Or winners for the best part of, what is it, 18 years, something like that. They have, one of them is the team that's won the most European Cups ever. The other is admittedly not the one that's won the second most, but I think the fourth most. They are two clubs with, I think, the two biggest club football stadiums in Western Europe. They have huge fan bases. I just don't think there's a club game that has all of the ingredients that this club game has. Now, it is true that right now these may not be the best two clubs in the world, but I think it's still the biggest rivalry.
All right, that was a relatively strong argument. I was expecting a few more sort of facts and stats to back it up, but okay.
Well, I mean, I haven't got the stats to hand, but I mean, I could go through them with you if you want, but it would take a while for me to go and fish them out and you know, kind of give you find my crib sheet and tell you the answers.
Leave the crib sheet. Let's get to what actually happened in the game. Obviously, Real Madrid taking the lead in the first half. A lovely, fantastic goal from David Alaba in his first Clásico. Then they were pretty much in control. Barcelona they threatened a little bit, but they never really threatened. My overriding sensation was that Real Madrid were comfortable in this game. Then they scored in injury time, Lucas Vázquez, to make it 2-0 before Kun Agüero scored with pretty much the final touch of the game. Did you have a similar kind of sensation that Real Madrid, without being brilliant in this game, were more or less in control?
Yes, absolutely I did. This was a game that I didn't think was a brilliant game. I didn't think the performance from Real Madrid was brilliant, but I thought the performance from Real Madrid, to use Carlo Ancelotti's words, was pragmatic and intelligent. And it was what they had to do. And I think there is sometimes a slight snootiness about a team that plays on the counter-attack. And I think it's problematic for a couple of reasons. I think it's problematic because it assumes that playing on the counter is easy. It's simplistic, perhaps, but it doesn't necessarily make it easy to do. And I think it's problematic because I think it tends to come almost with a kind of an ethical side to the argument, as if this is somehow illegitimate, and it's not illegitimate. And then I suppose there's a third thing, which is, if this is the way to beat Barcelona, why wouldn't you do it? And if this is a way that Barcelona think you're going to try and beat them, why wouldn't they do more to prevent it from happening? So that's the other part of this. And certainly in that first half, I was very, very struck. One player really, I think, outlined this to me, perhaps more than anyone else. And that player was Courtois. Mm. Every time Courtois got the ball, Real Madrid were on the attack. Because he would literally catch, boom, straight out. And they would go direct, and they would go very vertical, and they would normally go to Vinicius. It was amazing how often they looked for Vinicius. And yes, it was relatively simple. It was, there's a high Barcelona line, beyond them, or in front of them, Vinicius to turn and go at them. But more often than not, it was for Vinicius to turn and go beyond them. And then everybody runs from there. And I suppose, in a way, that's indicated by the first goal, which is, it's true, it's a loss of the ball from Barcelona quite high up. But then it's Vinicius escapes, Rodrigo's running with him, and then it's Alaba, the centre-back, who's run all the way from just in front of his penalty area into the other penalty area, who scores. Look at the goal, the second goal that Real Madrid scored. It's Lucas Vázquez who scores it, who again has come all the way from his own half to score the goal. And I felt that Real Madrid were very, very clear in their minds. This is what you do against Barcelona. This is how you go for them. Obviously, I think if you're going to individualise it, I think you can do it with two players. One is Vinicius, and two, and I hate to say this because I feel like it's being cruel, but one is Vinicius, and the other is the man that was marking Vinicius, Mingueza. And I think that was a really, really uneven matchup that Real Madrid made the most of. And then, as you say, you then get this environment in which, okay, Barcelona have the ball, but it felt like that wasn't purely accidental from Real Madrid's point of view. It felt like that was partly designed. Okay, they can have it. And you're right, I didn't think Barcelona created almost anything once it had that death chance. I believe it was only two shots on target in the entire game by the end of the game. And one, of course, is the goal in the 97th minute, which was too late.
The discourse from Ronald Koeman after the game wasn't entirely convincing. He seemed to think they'd played pretty well.
I think it's very, very interesting, the discourse from him after the game. And I think it's interesting discourse from one or two others as well. And I think it's quite...
We'll get to Ramon Planes' quotes in just a second.
Okay, right. Well, let's stay with Koeman for the moment then. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, and I think it's explanatory up to a point. Now, first of all, as you say, I don't find it entirely convincing. Koeman was saying we play very well. It was only really the pegada, you know, that ability to land the knockout punch
that meant that we didn't win this game. We had as many chances as them and clearer chances. Well, apart from the Dest one, I don't necessarily buy that. So that's one thing. I don't necessarily buy that idea that they played well. And yes, they sort of played as well as Madrid in that they had a lot of the ball. They territorially had the advantage. But it felt like, of course, playing well, I think, one way of defining it is to say, have you succeeded in doing the things you were planning to do, you proposed mm-hmm. to do? And I think Barcelona didn't. And I think Real Madrid, broadly speaking, did. I think it was partly design. It wasn't just they were pushed back by Barcelona. Although Ancelotti did say after the game, I'd like us to have this solidity a bit higher up the pitch. I don't really want us to have this solidity quite so far back. But I think broadly speaking, Madrid did what they want. And so that's one reason why I didn't really buy that from Koeman. But the other reason why I think what Koeman said is interesting is because it felt like, and this of course goes back to the it is what it is comments and goes back to Koeman talk about realism. It feels like this narrative, this discourse is counterproductive. It's embracing and I think deepening a sense of inferiority, which I think is problematic. Even if it is a reality, I think it's problematic. And I think that from a player's point of view, if your manager's effectively saying, well, what am I supposed to do with this lot? I'm not sure if it necessarily helps very much. I think that if you have a club like Barcelona and you approach the big games in a way that says, okay, and this game, in fairness, is different to the Bayern games. The Bayern game, for example, the Benfica game. But we want the ball, but, you know, there's this sense of impotence that's embraced. And I'm not sure that's a great thing. And I think what it does is it creates, even if on a subconscious level, it creates an excuse behind which players can hide. And it justifies, I think, a certain degree of, not failure as such, but it justifies a degree of perhaps a lack of ambition, or it justifies perhaps a lack of being demanding. And now Koeman, to be fair to him, said after the game, of course you have to demand of this team winning these kind of matches, because he was asked specifically about the big games. So they've been beaten by Atleti, beaten by Madrid, beaten by Bayern Munich, obviously.
Beaten by everyone in every big game he's played since he was Barcelona manager, except a group stage match against Juventus last season.
Yeah, exactly. And then he said, you know, and yes, we do have to demand these, but then he said, we're getting close to beating a big team. Now, I know that there is a reality. And up to a point, I've been quite defensive of Koeman because I think some of what he says is right. I think there is a reality there. I think there are young players that he's bringing in through. I think there are some signs of advance in that sense. But that idea, I just don't buy it entirely. And just to say, we're getting close to beating a big team. People think, are you? First of all, are you? And secondly, is close to beating a big team good enough for a club like Barcelona, even this Barcelona?
I mean, I think it's one of, and to forgive me if I sound like a American high school teenager, it's one of the lamest things I've ever heard.
We're getting
close to beating a big team. What kind of thing is that to say as manager of Barcelona? I don't care what state you're in, what state the club is in. Come on, man. Yeah. You can't come
and
out
that, and say and that. That, by the way, is about the if you like, the construction of the consciousness around the club, right? And about around the team and with the fans and so on. And as I say, there's been times when I've kind of been able to accept that because I think what he says sometimes is true, that there is a reality and so on. But then this is before we even talk about the construction of the team. That's the construction of the conscious. The construction of the team. And I'm always very, very conscious, and I say this often, of the fact that these are qualified coaches. These are people who know the game. These are people who work on it. These are people who see their players in training. These are people who come armed with huge amounts of information that I haven't got and huge amount of expertise that I haven't got. But sometimes there are things that happen that you think, this seems almost too easy. How has this not been seen? For example, I mean, you could argue that he did see it and that he took Mingetha off at half-time, but the damage that Vinicius was doing, the sense of panic every time Vinicius got the ball in the first half, it struck me that, well, what's happening here? Why is this not being seen? Why is that defensive line still so high if you're not pressing to get the ball back? If you press to get the ball back, you make up the defensive line being high because you don't allow the other team to play those passes. But if you don't put any pressure on that other team, those passes are so easy to play. And then Vinicius, and you know, Koeman said yesterday, one of the phrases he used was, it's almost impossible to stop that kind of counter-attack. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that it's almost impossible to stop this is really a thing you want to hear from your manager as well. Because it's never impossible to stop something. There's always ways. And he's incredibly quick, and it's very hard to do that. And I thought that some of the discourse post game was a bit like, well, it's almost like it doesn't count because it's a counter attack. And the one Barcelona player who I thought challenged that, and it was really interesting talking to him after the game, was Ter Stegen. So look, they do this really well, Real Madrid, and we didn't put the pressure on them, and we didn't create chances, and they made better chances than us. And I thought, at least there's someone here analysing this, you know.
I said we'd talk about or mention at least the comments from Ramon Planes, who is the technical secretary of Barcelona, who basically after the game says, we don't have the players, the high-level players, or the goal-scoring ability that we used to have. I'm translating here. In Spanish, he said, no tenemos los jugadores de nivel y la pegada que teníamos.
Which, of course, is true. But I don't know if that's necessarily enough for the slightly anemic nature of the rest of the performance, if you see what I mean. It's not that you didn't. You see, one of the problems I have is that the use of the word pegada, the ability to deliver that knockout blow, quite literally the punch, right?
Yeah.
Is that it makes it sound like you've created lots of chances, but you've missed them. Mm. But you haven't. You've created one chance that you missed. One. One genuinely clear chance, which is a really clear chance. And yes, it is true that if Dest scores, it changes everything. Potentially, because maybe Madrid have to play differently. Maybe you can then play differently. But and obviously, by Madrid scoring first, it reinforced an idea that had already taken shape. But I thought that was a strange comment. And he said it was... he described it as an aprobado, which is like an exam, you've passed it. Barcelona have passed the exam. And I was thinking, have they though?
What is that like? What is that in? What is the actual figure that you get to pass the test here?
Aprobado, I think, is a 6. Is it 5 out of 10? It's a 5 or a 6, yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. Right. And I think he might actually have called it an aprobado bueno. So I suppose you're saying it's like a C+ or a B+ or something. So in other words, you know, it's all right. It's all right. And I just thought, well, I don't know if that's the narrative. Now, admittedly, at least now you're getting the sporting director and the manager saying the same thing, where, of course, very recently we had the manager and the president clearly saying very different things, and the breakup was there.
Mm. Okay, shall we talk about Real Madrid and what Carlo Ancelotti did and did well? Because there were, I wouldn't say eyebrows raised when Lucas Vázquez...
Ancelotti's eyebrow was probably raised.
Always. But in the starting 11, we saw Lucas Vázquez at right back, and it felt like a slightly more attacking option than perhaps putting Nacho there. He went 4-3-3 as well with Rodrigo instead of starting Valverde in midfield. It felt like he had a pretty clear idea of how Real Madrid were going to approach this.
Yeah, I think he had a very clear idea, and I think that's maybe one of the other differences between him and Koeman. Whether you like what Ancelotti's doing or not, there was a clarity to it. The message was really quite simple, and we've talked about it. He wanted it to be what the Spanish always describe as a mid block. So I suppose if you picture where the defensive line is, I suppose you've basically got high, mid, and low, and so it's sort of somewhere in the middle. So you're waiting for Barca, but not waiting for them too deep, which I think explains why he then said after the game, "I'd like us to defend this solidly, but a little bit higher." But in the end, it worked because it really was. Here's the team. There's Vinicius, Rodrigo and Benzema. When the team is right back here, we get it and we go, boom, we go to them. And then we get the rush towards them, effectively. So it starts from there. So that was very clear. I think with Lucas Vázquez, what he got was energy, rather than necessarily more attackingness. I think he got more energy than he would have done with Nacho. I think he was clear in the structure, and he said in midweek that it had to be 4-3-3. He even made the point of explicitly saying, you can't play Valverde in a front three. And so it will be wingers. I think that he'd been very clear. Well, the players apparently after the game, speaking to someone afterwards, were surprised how comfortable it had been, the Madrid players. Surprised sort of how simple this approach had been. And I think there's a broader question to be asked about Ancelotti, which is that this season he has talked a lot about the defensive side of the team. He's constantly said how unhappy he was with them the way they were defending early in the season. Kept saying it, didn't he? Even in quite good performance, he would say, I didn't like the way they were defended. And he came up with that really nice line, which was, I want defenders to be pessimists. I want them to think the worst. I want them to be ready for the worst, so to be prepared for it, rather than believing, oh, I can run up the pitch and score. And then he said this weekend, he said, look, some of the talent stuff is genetic. That's not my job, in a way. He was effectively saying, it's my job to build a structure around them which they can work and make sure that we're defensively strong. And they were. And David Alaba played, I thought, very well indeed. beyond the fact that he scored a goal, I thought he defended very, very well. Mendy obviously is important, if only because it gives a more defensive figure to that back four, and I think someone who judges his position better than the other fullbacks do. And I think that, you know, Ancelotti was very, very clear about what he wanted. And it is back to that defensive thing. And I don't know if this Madrid team has enough going forward for this to be successful in Europe. But I think it might be enough to be successful in Spain.
Okay. We'll see. Neither of them are top of the table going into this fixture. Yeah. They were fourth and eighth, respectively.
Yeah, because we should be clear about this. Madrid played well and they executed this plan pretty well, but this isn't a great performance. It's not like, wow, this is one to remember. It's a performance where it felt like they, and it's difficult to say this because it's intangible and you can't judge it, but it felt like they were playing slightly within themselves, or at least they were playing in a way that said, we know what to do.
Mm.
Rather than right, we're going for them. Okay, we've got it now, and we'll just play from here.
If you disagree, tell us why we're absolutely wrong. Send us a question and we'll answer it on the Q&A pod that we're recording tomorrow for patrons. There's lots more that we could discuss. The final thing I want to mention about the Clásico is the atmosphere. Mm. 86,422 fans there, which is possibly quite a few more than we were expecting. It's still, though, the lowest Clásico attendance since 1988, bearing in mind that the stadium holds 99,000, so it wasn't full. It wasn't far off being full. It looked pretty full and it felt like a proper occasion, certainly at the beginning.
It did, yeah. Yeah, it did. I personally, look, this is just a personal thing and I don't know what other people feel about it. I feel like these games should be at night. There's something a bit more dramatic, a bit noisier about
But the people in China need to watch it, Sid.
Well, yeah, but you can still But then there's people on the others. It's sort of, obviously there's people in lots
That's
of
why 4:15 is the perfect time.
Well, it is for that market, but what about other markets? So, you know, there's never a perfect time for everybody unless we all
it's 4:15. That's the perfect time.
Yeah.
Because then everybody's awake. Even the Pacific Coast, you can get up at 7 o'clock and watch it. It's not in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, okay. But anyway, I think in terms of an occasion, I mean, you are... Because in fairness, you asked me about the atmosphere rather than the television audience.
Yes.
So, and it was good. I think what stopped it being full apparently was season ticket holders not turning up. There's doubts about.
Yes.
There's some season ticket holders who aren't turning up. There are some season ticket holders who still don't seem to have quite worked out what's happening with their tickets. But in terms of the tickets on sale, I think they'd sold almost all of them, despite them being pretty expensive. By the way, it's not like these were selling very cheap. And it was good. By the end, obviously, it was drifting a bit. And when Aguero scored, there was a bit of a like, oh, come on, then is there a chance? But it literally, nobody thought that there was. But it was nice. It was nice to see this game with that noise. I didn't think it was particularly hostile. But then I suppose that might again be explained by significant numbers of tourists who perhaps come with less hostility towards Real Madrid than Barcelona fans would from the city.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Not enough hostility for your life.
I mean, also, there isn't really a hate figure at Real Madrid now, I don't suppose, either.
Well, they were whistling Vinicius in the first half.
I think that's because they were frightened of him.
Yes. All right, listen, like I said, there's lots more that we could discuss, but if you want us to talk about something, send us a question, and we will. I'm actually conscious of the fact that you might not have seen Atletico Madrid against Real Sociedad.
No, I saw that one because we had to cover that one. The one I haven't seen, to my great despair, of course, is the Sevilla Levante.
Well, yeah, no one watched that. I mean, that was
I literally saw about 15 minutes of it in the mobile unit outside the Camp Nou, but that was all I got to see.
Oliver Torres scored an unbelievable goal for Sevilla, the first goal. Munir scored a fabulous goal for Sevilla as well. Morales scored a brilliant goal for Levante as well. There were some really great strikes in that, but we didn't watch the game, so we can't really talk about that. Let's talk about Atleti against La Real, which finished 2-2. La Real were flying. They were 2-0 up at half-time. Imanol Alguacil going with a back five, surprising everybody. Loads of injuries as per usual for La Real. No first choice left back in the squad. Had players out in basically every line of the pitch. But he said, nah, don't worry, not a problem. And I really like that about Imanol Alguacil. Whenever he's asked about the injuries, he said, nah, it's fine, it's cool, I will just get on with it. I've got players, it's not a problem, don't worry about the injuries. Played five at the back, and to begin with, Atleti had absolutely no idea of how to break them down, despite starting Griezmann, Suarez and João Félix for the first time together.
Yeah, it's not just Atletico Madrid that couldn't work it out, nor could I. I'm holding up to you now my notebook. I mean, I don't know how well you can see that. You probably can't, but it's got arrows on it. I was trying to work out the Real Sociedad team as the first few minutes unfolded.
It took a while, man. It took a while. Because I was watching it with two ex-managers and they didn't know what was going on.
I was
on
looking
for a while,
at it thinking, hang on a minute. Is Thaldua playing at right wing?
Yeah,
is Sorloth. They are both playing at right wing. And I think that doesn't make any sense. And actually, I don't know if you heard this, and I thought it was really, really interesting. Imanol Aguathil, after the game, admitted that he played a different formation for the first 5 minutes to try and confuse Atletico, so they wouldn't understand what. So he said they put so Saldua becomes almost this right winger to start with. So it is a four, but you've got this random player there, and then he drops in to make kind of a five. So you've got a line of five, and you've got Guevara with Marino, and then you had Silva, Isak, and Sorloth sort of in a triangle, not quite in a line, more in a triangle. At the top, and it was a very unusual formation for them because they normally play either a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1 or sometimes a 4-1 and then the rest of the team structured in front of that, and they were really, really good. They the way they cut through Atletico for the first goal was superb. Admittedly, partly drawn out, partly aided by the fact that Felipe was drawn so far out to win a ball that he couldn't win. But it was I think it was four consecutive first time passes, ping out, ping back in again, ping out and ping through, bing boom boom, and he's clean through.
Yeah.
And it was they were very, very good. And we've talked about them this year. They're one of the things that's interesting about Real Sociedad this year, I think, is that they are slightly different to the way they've been over the last 18 months. There's been a slightly more defensiveness to them. There's been a bit more variety in formations. They've been fortunate a couple of times. They were fortunate against Elche. They were fortunate against Mallorca a little bit with the late goal, which was a bit of a deflection. But as you say, they have these problems. They said, right, we'll find a solution. And this was a very, very unexpected solution. And it worked really well. Admittedly, they then found themselves in the second half with Atletico bombing at them. But Imanol said after the game, I really quite like this line. He said, well, what? So we suffered against Atletico. Well, yeah. 3 days ago, the almighty Liverpool suffered against Atletico Madrid. We didn't for a minute think we would come here and not have it difficult. And I also thought there was something very interesting in what he said post-game. It's the first time I think I've ever heard him engage with the idea of competing for the title. Now, he didn't exactly, but he hinted at it. Like every other time he said, oh no, use that great Spanish phrase, it's anecdotico. You know, the league, our league position is just an anecdote. This doesn't mean anything. And then this time, he actually talked about how it's difficult to stay there. The team that wins the league will probably get 80 points, and it's quite difficult for us to get that. Now, so he's not engaging with it in the sense, he's not saying, yes, we can do this, but he's actually engaging with the, if you like, the mechanics of it. And I don't think I've ever heard him do that before.
What, sort of actually making the calculations, thinking in his mind how many you're going to need.
Which made me think, he's thought about this. He's wondered whether this is possible.
Well, they're top of the table after 10 games. It's, you know, with almost, what was it?
Let's not do the maths.
Almost a quarter of the way through. Yeah, we're over a quarter.
Yeah, we are now, exactly. We were on the threshold before. That's what confused us.
Atleti once again conceding first. They've gone behind to Villarreal, which they ended up drawing very fortuitously. Espanyol, which they ended up winning also quite fortuitously. Getafe, they won that as well late on. Alaves, they lost that. Milan, they won. Liverpool, they lost. And now La Real, which they drew. We're not used to this. We're not used to seeing Atletico Madrid having to come from behind. Not usually they go in front, know how to defend their lead, shut up shop, and they're solid. That's not working this season. And they're conceding much more goals than we're used to as well.
What was it Simeone said? He said, we score two. We've got to stop conceding. He was asked if he was worried about this, and he said yes. Now, obviously, in Spanish, there's that nice, what would you call it, linguistic quirk, which is that worried, to be worried about something and to be busy doing something is almost the same word. So he said, we are preocupados, pero también ocupados. In other words, yes, we're preoccupied by this, we're worried by this, but we're also, you know, kind of applying our minds to it to try and find a solution. And I thought it was interesting that he said he was worried, because he never normally admits that. And he said he was asked about playing Griezmann, João Félix and Suarez together and whether this could happen again. And he said it could if we can find the balance. to make this work so that we're not getting caught at the other end. And obviously one of the ways of providing the balance is a player has to go from somewhere if those three are going to play, unless Griezmann plays as a midfielder. A player has to go from somewhere. This weekend, of course, what the player that went from was from the back. So they played four instead of five. And I don't think their defensive problems are necessarily about that, because I think with better personnel or better concentration or better fitness levels of certain players, then I think you can perfectly well play that formation with a four rather than a five. But of course it meant losing Carrasco, because he's been this kind of hybrid left wing back, sort of left winger sort of thing that he was. You can keep Trippier because he can be a right back as well as a right wing back, so that's okay. But you do then have doubts about your defenders, and I think you have doubts in particular because I think Felipe is slightly flawed at times. I think without Savic they've got problems. He was brilliant last year. Jimenez keeps having physical problems. And then the other defender, of course, is Hermoso. Now, I think last year Hermoso was brilliant, and I think he was really important because he played that hybrid role of being the left centre-back who became the left-back when Carrasco went up the pitch. And I think he was really important because he was the one, what do we call this, who had Salida, who brings the ball out, who had an eye for a pass. But I think defensively, he makes mistakes that others don't make. And I think there is a lack of security about that back four now. And I must confess, I don't know what the answer is. But if you change the structure to fit the front three in, then of course, by definition, that probably needs a bit of time to bed in. And yesterday, by the way, I have no idea what formation Atletico were playing by the end.
No.
Because he made so many changes.
It was just, yeah.
He made so many changes, but it was changes that were not like this player for another one that's similar, or even as obvious as this player goes up front and we'll just lose a man at the back. It really was repositioning people all over the place. And it did work, in fairness, because they did create chances. And they do look good, Atletico, with the ball. And they do look like a properly good team. But I wonder if it's one that they... Well, to use Diego Simeone's own words, that hasn't yet found the balance between those two things.
Luis Suarez basically didn't touch the ball but scored twice.
I honestly, genuinely do not know what to say about Suarez in this sense. Because I will admit this, and you know, regular listeners all know that I defend Suarez in the sense that I think we shouldn't overlook the significance of scoring goals, which I know sounds bleeding obvious, but I think we sometimes do. We seem to assume that, oh, he's just the guy on the end of it, and if he wasn't there, someone else would be on the end of it. But it doesn't work like that. It really doesn't work like that. But it is also true that I watch games like this one and a few others this season away at Getafe, which I was at, was a similar game. Actually, no, I think away at Getafe, he actually played quite well bringing others into the game. But I've certainly seen him this season play games. We think, he's done nothing. You've got to take him off. And then he scores.
He doesn't take him off.
There was a game, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was definitely the Wanda because I saw someone who works with Simeone.
Okay, he's taken him off three times. Okay.
I saw someone who works with Simeone, and Simeone admitted that he was getting ready to take Suarez off when Suarez scored. And I can't remember which game it was. But that's the thing about Suarez. If you want presence in the area, he is still their best striker by a very, very long way. But he's definitely not their best footballer.
Oh, goodness, no. But so six goals now.
Exactly. And what if you didn't have him, I think they wouldn't have come back in these games that they've had to come back in. And I don't just mean that because, well, state in the bleeding obvious, look, there's his goals that prove it. I think it's more than that.
Yeah, he scored both goals when they came back against Getafe. One of them was unbelievably good. Scored both goals against La Real, scored against Barcelona as well. Well, we know he's going to keep scoring, and yeah, he's going to keep leaving us scratching our heads because there's loads of games where he doesn't do anything, and then he's absolutely vital. There's so much other stuff we could talk about, but we've run out of time. So we'll save it either for your question podcast or maybe for later on in the week as well. Before we go, the Segunda División, Almeria are top. They won 4-1 at Mirandés on Sunday. Eibar up to second. They beat Cartagena 2-1 on Friday. Sporting a third, but they were beaten at home by a resurgent Valladolid. Las Palmas are going well in fourth. And Oviedo won 2-1 at Ponferradina. Leganés are still in the relegation zone. They were beaten 2-1 at Butarque by Tenerife. Coach Asier Garitano said Borja Garcés won't play again for Leganés after the on-loan Atletico Madrid forward skipped the match to attend his brother's wedding when he was specifically told, you can't go. And he went anyway. It's not going well for our favourite cucumber growers. Sydney, thank you very much. We'll speak tomorrow on the Q&A pod for our lovely patrons. If you fantastic listeners aren't patrons, don't worry. We'll be back, as ever, here next Monday. Adios.
Cheerio.